Law today, to talk to you about their work. Simon and Thomas, you might notice, look quite similar to each other. So they're brothers, twins, make their work together. Currently, they're based between London and Birmingham, but soon to be based only in Birmingham. Simon and Tom make installation, sculpture, work in public realm, a lot of printed material that kind of interacts with those things. They're very interested in kind of ideas of modernism, particularly sort of British mid-20th century, the ideals of British mid-20th century modernism, elements of that that may have failed, kind of aspiration towards social housing, play structures, those kinds of sort of movements that happened in the sort of 50s and 60s in the UK that have a kind of utopian edge to them but are tinted with potential failure or quite a particular failure in some cases. Recently they've been kind of doing a range of works that have interacted with educational institutions in different ways. You've done two separate projects, haven't you, in Bristol now?
Yeah.
West Town Primary School and also at Cotton School, where they've worked with the schools to make permanent works in those schools that kind of augment the educational environment. At the moment they're working with me in Froom on a project by Foreground, where they've been working on new installation works for the town, but by looking at relationships with education and the town's physical environment, with how teenagers, young people might use the town as a kind of basis for how they might start thinking about ideas. There's been ups and downs in that process, which I'm sure they might tell you about in a moment. That project opens on Saturday 22nd of March, so two Saturdays time. And goes into sort of full production installation next week. So they've got some of the designs for that work and they can talk about it a little bit later on. So without further ado, Simon and Tom Bloor.
Thank you. So just to start, can everyone hear me? And can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Simon's hinted we're going to go through some work of the last 5 years. Various projects, actually not so many of the kind of more artists ephemera type projects that we were doing slightly before this work, but starting with an exhibition that we did in 2009 that has been, I think, quite a kind of, in a way, quite a surprise to both, was a very kind of formative project. So I guess if we... So this was an exhibition that we did back in 2009 at Eastside Projects Gallery in Birmingham, where we are among the founder directors. Go on, do you want to...
Eastside Projects, if any of you have been, know about it. It's kind of the whole point of Eastside Project, or one of the kind of important things, is that it's kind of a... the gallery itself is almost like an art project. Mm. So we were kind of invited to do something there before the gallery had even opened. And I think ours was like the fourth show, something like that. And because we'd been kind of involved from the outset, we kind of knew the space and we're kind of thinking about how what we do might work in that space. And one of the things that we did, which I don't think we've got a slide of, unfortunately, is on one of these columns in the middle of the room, there was a text piece by Lawrence Wiener, which said, "As long as it lasts." So, and we had actually installed that piece for Wiener. So we kind of said, well, we knew that Lawrence Wiener had said that he wanted the gallery to respond to his text. He was initially invited to kind of do something that he, in response to the space, and he said he wanted to make a piece of work that the space had to respond to. So we kind of took that quite directly and we said, okay, we'll kind of steal that for our project. And I think the kind of idea of as long as it lasts sort of fit with kind of some of the sort of thoughts that were going on in the show. So one of the key things was were these trees. We had these 20 silver birch trees in the exhibition, which actually when it, I think it started, they were like this with kind of no leaves on, and then throughout the kind of run of the show they gradually came into leaf, and so there's this kind of really like, and we didn't really know that was quite going to happen. No. And that became a really nice sort of element to the show. And then alongside that there were these kind of sculptures and kind of objects and these sort of planter pot things and various other sort of drawings and things that kind of all sort of dealt with aspects of kind of sculptural processes, and particularly ideas around kind of play sculptures. And in Birmingham, there are a number of either still existing or kind of now lost or flick through. So this was kind of one of the first things that we did, was this drawing from a photograph of a kind of, it's sort of like a, I don't know, kind of concrete, kind of mid-20th century sort of, we just knew this sculpture and we thought it kind of looked like a sort of second-rate kind of Hepworth or Henry Moore or something. And it's still there in Birmingham on this kind of plot land. And we didn't know who this was by at the time, even kind of until fairly recently. So we, but we kind of did this drawing, we included it in the show, and it's, and then from that we kind of extracted a series of other kind of works. So we did some more drawings of these kind of play sculptures and these sculptures around Birmingham, and then we kind of made these models that were, or these sculptures that were kind of models for play sculptures, but they were kind of already failed before they'd even been kind of made. And we kind of, I think that idea of sort of failure is something that kind of comes up a lot in our work, that which, like, you know, not hopefully not from our work, it was just kind of, you know, our work failing, but I mean, failure is always an option. I think that's kind of one of our things that we kind of like the idea of. But so yeah, we kind of made these sort of sculptures that were kind of like as though they were, there was this kind of space where a kind of park or piece of waste ground where there were all these kind of trees, and then they kind of, these sculptures somehow kind of been chucked there and then kind of been kind of come together to kind of make this kind of space. And everything was kind of manufactured, so the kind of planters are cardboard coated in jesmonite, which is kind of like plaster based
resin,
sort of resin type material, and the kind of bricks for the plinths are polystyrene. So yeah, the whole show was this kind of quite it was in a way, I suppose, it's quite staged sort of space that kind of was both indoor and kind of sort of outdoor, and kind of looked like a piece of waste ground, looked like a park, looked like a, and I suppose the use of silver birch trees is quite important because they're something that get planted by in kind of developments, but also are grow completely kind of wild and are kind of called a pioneer species because they just sort of root anywhere. So yeah, we're going to kind of flip forward. So we had this, we knew about these play sculptures, and we knew about this one particularly. And then we subsequently, after doing that show, maybe like a year, 2 years later, we got an email from somebody in Leamington Spa who runs the kind of the gallery there, and said that they were doing this exhibition by John Bridgman, who was the guy that we had kind of assumed had made this, you know, that sculpture, but we didn't know for certain. And we so then they kind of invited us to kind of, they were doing a retrospective of John Bridgman's work, so we went and met with them. Bridgman,
it should be said that we knew very little about Bridgman's work.
Yeah, we knew nothing about Bridgman's work. He was a guy who happened to, he taught in Birmingham for a while. He made some work of varying kind of quality. He did some terrible sculptures and some pretty bad drawings. But he also kind of interestingly made like 20 of these sculptures around Birmingham, and so there's the only one that still exists. And then the other ones have all been kind of destroyed, but they're kind of, and there's this story about how he knew Henry Moore, and Henry Moore had invited him to be a studio assistant, and he had said, no, I am kind of an artist in my own right,
my own
kind
path,
of,
yeah.
And he kind of went off and didn't work for Henry Moore, but he's kind of, you know, in a way his work is, and I think this is what we're kind of drawn to, a lot of these kind of artists who are you know, the kind of lesser known modernists, and kind of really, you know, their work isn't, you know, it's not as good as Hepworth or Henry Moore if you kind of make a direct comparison, but there's something there that's kind of really interesting for us.
And also the idea of the intent, you know, the intent with these were that they were places for children to play on, works for children to play on, rather than works to be enjoyed on a country estate or any of those kind of things. Mm. So there's something there that kind of appeals to us.
And they're kind of concrete rather than bronze or whatever, which is kind of nice. So we kind of went back to the original show that we did, where this was the starting point. So this was one of the sculptures that we made, and we kind of took this form and kind of converted it into a structure. So our initial proposal was that they invited us to do something for outside of the gallery. So inside the gallery is this retrospective of John Bridgman's work, and then outside the gallery they wanted a sculpture in the ground, in the kind of grounds that, or the part that's adjacent to the gallery. We kind of said, well, okay, let's make something that can be used, I guess, by kind of anyone. But the initial starting point was the idea that it might be used by the people who would once have played on the Bridgman sculptures in the kind of 1950s and 60s. What would they want to do now? And we just thought, well, just some sort of shelter and a kind of place to sit. Actually, it became used inevitably by kind of piss artists and teenagers. We kind of met, we had this sort of fabricated, and we were really lucky.
So do you want to say it's a wooden frame?
Oh yeah,
with lined with polystyrene and then coated in concrete. But the inside, we kept the wood inside, and we kind of initially we just sprayed quite lightly, just kind of sprayed with a bit of spray paint. That's something we've been doing for a few of our works, is that kind of preemptive vandalism, and also that we did an exhibition at Modern Art Oxford where we sprayed the areas that were of seating in order to kind of give a sense that those were the areas that were kind of activated by some kind of activity, but actually you had to make the decision, do you want to sit next to a load of spray paint or, you know. But what happened was that quite a lot of the local kids and, you know, local people added to the graffiti with their graffiti, which wasn't always the kind of, like, I mean, it was a bit tricky because we had to make the decision, do we censor some of the graffiti that was, like, racist or homophobic and that kind of thing, because we didn't necessarily want that associated with our project. So we did kind of, you know, go over with a bit of paint thinners and respray over the top. So there was some censorship of the graffiti that was added to by the local kind of populace.
Yeah, but that kind of idea of how you, or whether you guard against vandalism and destruction and things, is something that kind of has recurred kind of more recently as well, which we'll talk about in a bit. This is the Modern Art Oxford show that Simon mentioned, and it was in, they had this space that they called the Yard. It was kind of a fairly new sort of exhibition space between, and it originally had been the cafe and things, and it's sort of, so it was kind of this slightly weird, it's like it was a their kind of good yard, delivery yard. And so they'd had it lined with these kind of wooden walls, and it was sort of an entrance to the gallery, but they had kind of a big shutter at one end, so it sort of feels a bit inside, a bit outside. So we kind of were interested in that, and we kind of wanted to use it. So we made this sort of slightly kind of maze-like structures with just fencing, hit and miss style fencing, and like in a way there's this, I think a lot of our work, there's this sort of a kind of nostalgia, but it's sort of a little bit deliberately kind of ambiguous. You know, I think we kind of, a lot of it we do really like, there is something kind of interesting, but it's also, we're completely aware that the stuff that we kind of enjoy is stuff that is problematic, and a lot of people hate it for kind of understandable reasons, I think. But we just think they're kind of slightly wrong. This style of fencing was something that we kind of remember from when we were kids, sort of looking through it, and it was kind of a weird thing when we started talking about it. And we just said, yeah, I remember it was like in where some uncle and aunt lived, and just have a sort of weird memory of kind of peeking through this fence. And so we thought, well, okay, let's use that as a starting point. And then we kind of thought about this idea of kind of like a maze-like structure. So within it, yeah, you had these sort of bits of spray paint that kind of were almost like, because we painted it and it all looked a bit too polite and too nice, this kind of white fence. So we were like, okay, let's spray it, and they become kind of like bruises. And I think there's that thing with our work where we've done stuff in the past where people have talked about it in relation to stuff like graffiti, and we've just thought, oh, you know, it's not about graffiti in terms of like embracing that. It's kind of like, it's that kind of ambiguity thing. There's partly this idea that maybe that just becomes, it becomes part of the urban kind of environment, but also they become like bruises on architecture maybe. And then alongside that, we kind of made these posters, which are were based on exhibition posters for past shows at the gallery. That's a good one there. So it's like that's for a Dan Graham show from like '67 or something like that. And we just changed. We kept the image, redrew it, and then changed all of the details. So the details were for our show.
So there was with the posters, there are a couple of things like trying to find the right typeface, and that were kind of slightly laborious things about us going online and saying, does anyone know what this typeface is, to kind of like type a file websites and things. But there's also the idea of doing these things taking these posters by, I mean, it was slightly kind of, because we went through the whole archive of posters at the gallery, which is quite a kind of large archive, because the gallery's never moved, so they've kind of kept everything. And just kind of selected, it was slightly a mixture of ones that we thought had resonance with the structure that we were building. So this, for example, is a copy of a Stephen Willett's poster. And we just kind of liked that kind of the geometric shape and how it kind of felt a bit maze-like. Or it was straight kind of fanboy, like the Dan Graham one. You know, we were fans of Dan Graham's work, and it was kind of like...
Solowit, Dan Graham... Carl Andre, Donald Judd. So these kind of, I don't know, there was kind of a complete, we liked this idea of the kind of hubris of it, of taking these like real heavy hitter important artists and we kind of steal their poster. And we kind of remake it but with our name on instead of their names. So this takes us to the first of the kind of school commissions that we have done in Bristol. So this is at Cottam School, and this is like there are two works that kind of relate to each other and kind of sort of partner with each other. And this was is in this kind of interior space that was called like the Hub, and it's kind of a social space and things like that. And through the doors there is the library. So we kind of deliberately, we wanted to do something on this because it was this like 3 meter high and like something like 17 meter long kind of expanse of white wall. So it was like, okay, that's crying out for some sort of something on there. And it was also this idea that it sort of felt like a kind of important, because it looked down on a social space, but also it was... the entrance to the library. So this idea that the library's been this kind of potential place for any kind of knowledge or any information that you would want to kind of gather. We proposed several different projects for here that sort of, thankfully, and at a time kind of irritatingly, got knocked back by the school staff. But, you know, in a way they were kind of right. Pains me to say it, but so eventually we kind of came to this sort of proposal, and we kind of just wanted to do something that was just pure kind of sort of geometric kind of abstraction. And we were thinking about, I suppose, those kind of modernist artists who did like, I don't know, Victor Passmore and people like that who made kind of mural works for kind of kind of public spaces, but also kind of made, you know, paintings and constructed things and sculptures and stuff. And we kind of thought, well, okay, this is, I mean, but up to this point, I think there were, those kind of artists were people that we'd looked at as reference points, but we thought, well, okay, what happens when we do it? You know, can we kind of revisit that territory, and how does that make sense to kind of do it from our perspective of, and the kind of the work that we make?
But it's also for us, this, I mean, this was the first project that we did that had to have a very long lifespan. It's got to last 25 years, which we hadn't done before. You know, they tended to be projects that lasted for 6 months or, you know, 6 weeks or whatever. So it was kind of, I guess, just trying to do something that we can, I mean, we've made things and then, you know, 5 years down the line, you think, oh, I'd have done that differently. So to do something that you're having to put in a kind of semi-public space, I mean, it's tricky because it's a school, so it's actually private property. So, but we still think of it as kind of like public work. It's kind of like, you know, there is a kind of responsibility there, both for the kind of the venue that's going to have this work, but also for ourselves, that we want to produce something that we can look back on and go, yeah, we still like that. That's not a total disaster kind of thing.
Well, what we don't know is whether they've put plasma screens and stuff like that over the top of it,
or whitewashed it,
or what.
Because this is it's acrylic paint directly on the wall.
So yeah, that just shows that. So this, the kind of grid pattern, it is something that kind of comes up a lot in our work, and I think it's just that way of give kind of grounding what we do, and it, like, even the things like colour as well. We tend to go with kind of primary colours or kind of fluorescence, the kind of fluorescent equivalents of primary colours and black. And I think it's that kind of thing of, like, giving ourselves some rules to kind of work within, and the kind of grid is really useful for that, to kind of create a kind of, framework and structure. So we kind of extended the grid. So this is the kind of plan view of the school, and it's a bit, there's kind of a slight curved line and at the top of that kind of purple bit, and that's sort of the hub is sort of inside there. So this was outside, so people would kind of walk across this kind of tarmac area and kind of enter the school into the hub, which is on the kind of the top left. The whole process, the way this kind of process worked, is kind of we were invited to do the project. We met with people from the school, the kind of the head and the school teacher and a governor, and there was a lot of kind of conversation about what work we'd done, what we would do. We proposed something that was rejected. We proposed something else, which is basically the same as the first thing, but slightly different, and that kind of got rejected. And then we kind of said, well, you know, because initially there'd been talk about how engaging the kind of students, and we didn't necessarily want to do a load of workshops and kind of go that route, but we just thought it'd be kind of interesting to have that voice to some extent. So we arranged for there to be a meeting with a team, like a kind of group of, I think, various ages and stuff, and we just said to them, well, you know, what, where, like, this is our work, and then we said, well, what can we do that would, well, what areas kind of do you think would be interesting for us to work with? And they just said straight away, okay, that area is a really boring kind of tarmac kind of thing. It had just been laid, so it was this fresh tarmac, so it was quite appealing. I guess if it was just an old kind of play area, it wouldn't have had the same kind of appeal, but because it was this sort of pristine tarmac, it kind of lent it, you know, it's obvious that you could sort of do something, because it was like the equivalent of the wall space inside, I suppose. There was also another thing about the school, was that it had this emphasis on performing arts and maths with its kind of specialisms. So we were like thinking, well, this looks, you know, there's kind of maths involved because it's a grid, and there's kind of, it kind of looks like some sort of futuristic mathematical language maybe. But also, we like this idea that you could have that having these markings that kind of look like some sort of game markings, or you know, it's just using that. It's like a kind of plastic stuff that you kind of heat onto the floor, like road marking stuff. But it kind of created kind of zones and spaces and was a bit maze-like, and it kind of offered potential for some sort of engagement, but we didn't want to be kind of prescriptive about that, what that was. So we like the idea that it's kind of up to the kind of kids at the school, whether they just completely walk across it or whether they actually sort of engage with it somehow. So yeah, it's kind of an, you know, I guess in a way it's kind of an offer to the school to kind of play with it. And apparently they did, you know, these weren't completely staged photos. I think people were sort of using it a bit. There's a nice, we haven't got the image, there's a nice one where the kind of all kids are sort of standing in different bits.
Yeah.
So this is kind of another sort of project that we've been doing for, since 2011. And it's hopefully being, well, it's being fabricated and it's hopefully going to happen this year. This is with an organisation called Future City, who are based in London but have got a base in another place in Cambridge as well. And we're doing stuff in London and Cambridge with them. And we just got kind of invited to do something.
Yeah,
this is the way it kind of works in different ways, actually. So sometimes you get a kind of direct invitation where you're like, we want you to work with us. And then sometimes there's sometimes there's calls for expressions of interest. I don't think we've ever got one of the projects where it's like an open call and we've done gone that route, which we've only applied for two or three.
Cambridge. Was open call.
Yeah, maybe. And then we were invited to apply. Yeah. And then there's this one. Then there's the way then there's when you're. I'm surprised we're not doing this more often. Actually, kind of disagreeing with each other. Where you're kind of invited to actually submit something, and then they select from that, which I think tends to be the, like, when it's in these kind of sort of public spaces where there's kind of lots of people involved, whether it's like a school or it's the developer or the architect or whatever. This one we were just asked if we were interested in doing something for it, and we said yes. And then they went and kind of gave our names with some other artists to the developer, and they kind of picked us, which is kind of nice. It's always good when you don't have to be interviewed for the things, I think.
But it was kind of interesting because we actually hadn't. I think when we sent the developer and the commissioner a group of images of our work, we didn't have the Cottam School stuff to send.
No.
That was still being developed, so we just sent them kind of a bunch of images, a temporary project. So it was kind of great that we got this, because it's a large scale project, it's for a fairly prestigious site, the architect, it's a kind of series of tower blocks in Battersea that are designed by Richard Rogers studio or whatever they call themselves. So it's kind of, you know, it's quite a prestigious site and quite a prestigious thing to be involved in. So it was great that we could, you know, we were selected based on a kind of, you know, not that much kind of public work.
And this is like the single biggest project and budget that we've had to deal with as well. And the total budget is like, well, the fabrication budget is like 120 grand. So we were like, okay, what can we do with 120 grand? And we've definitely spent every penny of it, which is quite nice. So those are just sort of initial, we were just coming up with kind of shapes and this idea of like almost like, because the other thing is that the initial thing was that they invited us to respond to the idea of art and play as well, but that was quite like play in its kind of loosest possible terms. So initially we were thinking about this idea of like almost like building blocks and these things that could have been sort of scattered around. But then we were thinking about, because play is something that's kind of occurred quite a lot in our work and or kind of ideas around play, and particularly through the kind of 20th century. And one thing that's kind of, I guess, gets talked about quite a lot recently is this idea of kind of natural play. And we were sort of saying, well, like, okay, is it more important that child touches something because it's stone or wood, or is it actually just that natural play offers structures and kind of ways of engaging with kind of, you know, climbing and falling and, you know, leaping and whatever, that the kind of off the shelf playgrounds don't offer. So we kind of sort of have gone with that idea that, well, okay, let's take the idea of natural play, but kind of make it in a more sort of structured, sculptural way. And kind of with ongoing kind of points of interest are sort of various people who've kind of done sort of playful landscape design. So the top two images are Aldo van Eyck, who was a Dutch architect who did between 1947 and 1976, I think, he did 700 playgrounds, at least 700 playgrounds in Amsterdam, which some of them were kind of tiny little pocket kind of areas, when some of them were quite a bit more expansive. But he did these kind of leaping stones and these kind of island things. And he also did those kind of turning bars and kind of climbing frames that now are kind of probably all being taken out of everywhere because everyone's worried about the kids hurting themselves. But he was just this kind of really interesting guy. One of the things he was really interested in is this idea of in-betweening, where you kind of take there's a development happening and then there's a kind of slip of land in between it and there's nothing. You know, normally that would just be a bit of kind of waste ground, but he said, okay, let's put a playground in there. And he kind of and also I think there's this idea of affordance, where you have a thing that's kind of designated for one use, but also it kind of can function in another way. So like the bottom image is Lawrence Halprin, and that's there's like a fountain kind of it's called Lovejoy Plaza Park or something.
It was actually
Oregon.
Very recently saved from demolition.
Yeah, and he's another kind of point of reference that we were interested in helping. He kind of was his wife was a kind of quite important like choreographer, and so I think this idea of how people act in space is something that kind of is really interesting to him, and he kind of always thought about when he's doing these kind of landscape designs. But also there's this sort of aesthetic thing that we like this kind of sort of geometry, but then there's this sort of also a kind of something kind of slightly it's kind of based on nature. And then that tied into this stuff, which is called Pulamite, which is a kind of Victorian fake rock. And you get a lot of it in kind of parks. And they were kind of, I don't know, it's just that kind of weird sort of Victorian thing. And essentially, it's like concrete with a load of other stuff inside it.
It's part of the Victorian obsession with the ruin.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a current theme with the Tate Britain have just got a show, Ruin Lust, it's open. So it's kind of, I guess, resonant again.
Yeah. So we were kind of looking at all these different things, these idea of play and these structures, and then these kind of idea of the kind of artificial rocks. So this is our kind of, was the kind of, well, SketchUp version of the design. So we wanted this sort of kind of tiered, kind of rocky outcrop thing, because it's all, you know, it's kind of a new development, it's kind of very expensive luxury apartments, and we wanted to kind of do something that would just felt slightly at odds with that. It didn't kind of want it to be comfortable, because I think the whole thing with kind of public art, and especially often when you're kind of working with developers and people, they want you to make something kind of nice that sits kind of nicely in their landscape, and to kind of you know, there's the idea that kind of a role of public art is to kind of essentially increase the value of private property. So we kind of wanted to do something that was kind of a little more well, you know, it's kind of a big chunk of concrete in this kind of carefully manicured little pocket park thing. So there's a kind of tree trunk, and we managed to find, this is the white poplar, and we really like the bark, this kind of diamond pattern. And so this is the tree trunk that we've had cast in bronze. So it's about 4 meters long, and it's just the, it was, we were just, it's from the park, really close to, they kind of were chopping the trees down in the park, close to the site where it's going to be put. And
but and it's the tree we made in SketchUp.
Yeah, you it's know, kind of, it was this weird thing where we were looking around, and then we started thinking, oh, maybe white poplar, like, aren't really, like, they tend to be very small and kind of slender and kind of, you don't tend to get the kind of forks in, and they kind of offered us this tree, and it's like, yeah, that's a perfect tree. So, so yeah, you can still, I mean, there's quite a lot of detail that's still there, and it's going to be kind of patinated and things. So this is in the MDM, who are the kind of fabrication company. And this is the other thing about these projects that's kind of interesting, that we're completely, like, in terms of the actual process of production, we're now having to be completely hands-off. It's all being made by the fabricators. And then we occasionally go in and see it. So yeah, they've made the cast the tree trunk, and that's going to be leaning against this kind of, I think it's about 3 meters by 5 meter kind of rocky, kind of tiered rocky outcrop thing. And then across the site there are going to be these stepping stones. So some of them are completely embedded, and these are the embedded ones. So these are like about 15 centimeters thick. They're real substantial things, because they've got to have like vehicles driving over them. And there's a guy whose job it is to basically make all of these. And there's, I think, altogether we're doing like 30 or 40 of them. And he's having to sand them down, like grind them, polish them by hand and stuff like that.
Well, using an electric...
Yeah, not literally, like a bit of sandpaper. Yeah. But, so yeah, they're kind of, they're coming along. And hopefully... So this is the other thing that is, you know, this has been like 3 years. Originally it was supposed to have been installed last November, but there's kind of delays with the whole development. It's a massive big kind of, I think what they said, they're digging down, is it, for basements, they're digging down the equivalent of 5 acres. So it's like, you know, it's a huge kind of thing. They're kind of putting a new tube stop in there. It's such a big development. So I guess our project, even though it's quite a big thing for us, for them it's kind of quite far down the list of stuff to deal with. So yeah, we kind of, you know, these things get delayed, and you know, that can be kind of frustrating. So yeah, that's a kind of ongoing project. So this is a slightly ongoing project, but it's kind of almost
near completion.
And this was another kind of invitation to do something. And this came from the Bristol Council and the Arnold Feeney, to make something for a school. And there was a very limited budget. And we've actually done something that, I think with other projects as well, where we've ended up doing something that's several times even the kind of budget that we managed to get, that's in a more expanded budget. Like, we kind of get sometimes overambitious, I think. But we were looking at the school and talking to the head a little bit about what they wanted for the school. And he was talking about this... putting some sort of a kind of outdoor classroom at the front of the like right in front of the kind of the main kind of school building. So we were kind of thinking, well, okay, I'd recently been to the Carola Muller Museum in sort of near Amsterdam, and there are a couple of really amazing kind of pavilions there, and those kind of pavilion structures and kind of kind of kiosks and things are something that we've kind of made and have kind of been interested in, I suppose. And we kind of sort of went with that idea of like, well, okay, if we, like, we knew the school were kind of going to be doing this kind of platform and kind of decking, and we knew that, I think the other thing that you have to do as well is kind of, you look at these projects and you kind of go, well, okay, can we get some money from somewhere else in the kind of the project? So we knew the school had a budget for doing some sort of structure, so we could add that to our budget, and then we could kind of do something kind of more interesting. And we, I think another thing that we kind of like using is kind of fairly pedestrian kind of materials, like every day.
Just to say about that, because this, we'll just, if you skip through the, like you can see it's made of, the structure is made, the basic structure is made of steel tubing. And as Tom says, we kind of tend to kind of, we what appeals to us are kind of quite pedestrian materials. Partly with the idea that we've only got X amount of money to spend, so let's use quite a kind of off-the-shelf basic material.
It will be cheap.
But what tends to happen is then you go, actually, maybe we should get it all powder-coated. And then suddenly the cost of it kind of escalates, which is what kind of pushed the price up.
Yeah.
So it becomes actually becomes quite bespoke. Because, I mean, at one point we did say about that actually there's be something slightly appealing about having it as just kind of galvanised steel that would kind of, I guess, go a bit greyer, and it could become quite an austere kind of structure outside the school. But we kind of stuck with the kind of, I guess, the slightly the colours of the dish style or something that kind of, you know, we did go with the colours of the dish style because we used grey instead of white. So it was kind of, I think there were a few kind of references that started to filter into this work. I mean, for example, these panels that you can see partly came about because Tom had been working on, been curating, co-curating an exhibition at Eastside Projects Puppet Show. So we started thinking about these kind of, these shapes that, that became kind of figure-like, or somehow they were like kind of puppets that surrounded the structure, that kind of looked outwards into the world. As the kids kind of sit, so they don't see the colour, they just get the kind of white back of it, so they, you know, you have to go outside of it to see the colour. Beyond the classroom kind of thing.
Yeah. So this is a kind of project that's sort of just been finished, but we've still got a lot more to do elsewhere in the same site. This is also with Future City, who did the kind of tree and rock thing.
So this is like, a place in Cambridge where I think they're built, is it 2,700 new houses are being built? So they're basically building a new kind of village, town outside an existing town. And we're doing site with other artists. There are a bunch of other artists, including Ivan and Heather Morrison, who are doing kind of, you know, taking one area. But we got the kind of art and play strategy, which is site-wide, so we basically are working with all the developers, there are like three or four developers, to deliver some form of kind of art and play interventions, which again comes back, I mean, largely our approach to it came back to the Aldo van Eyck idea of in-betweening and finding spaces that weren't really being used. So, or in this case, it was a site that there were kind of walls designated for that space, but no one really knew what they wanted them to look like. So we kind of took that on and have kind of developed this kind of scheme.
So these walls were there for, they wanted them to be like an acoustic barrier between the kind of properties and the road that's sort of behind where the photos are. And we kind of wanted to do this thing anyway. We were already talking about doing this sort of site-wide kind of... What happened was we got asked to do... I keep sort of not finishing my sentences, but I'm going to kind of... I always do that anyway. But we were asked to propose something. And I think what happens a lot with these projects as well is they want you to do something that relates to the history of the site. And often there isn't anything that interesting about the site, or interesting in a way that you would want to engage with it as a project. So we kind of came up with this idea that, well, okay, let's create a kind of, like, we were looking at this archaeological finds for the site, and there were little kind of bits of broken pot and some kind of Roman coins and things like that. But we started saying, thinking about the idea of like, what could, like, it's a new, brand new development. What could a future archaeology for the site be like? So we kind of created these sort of ruin kind of play climbing wall things that are also maybe an acoustic barrier.
Maybe an acoustic barrier.
Yeah, I mean, it's got holes in. I mean, but they did run some tests apparently. But they, but yeah. So we kind of we like this idea that they're kind of they look like a kind of brutalist ruin, and we just sort of like the idea that we're doing that on this brand new kind of development where people hadn't even bought any of their houses yet. And we kind of thought, well, what if nobody bought, everyone just goes, oh, well, I'd buy a house here, but I'm not going to buy one because of that, those walls, you know, it would ruin it for the whole development. But we haven't. So yeah, but again, it's that idea of like, well, public art doesn't, it's, you know, we don't want it to be pretty. We no. want it to be challenging, you know. So in addition to the walls, we did this sort of these friezes on the front of the two of the buildings that were kind of where it was like it's actually kind of blasted into the building. And again, that was kind of that sort of take on those kind of municipal kind of architectural details of kind of post-war kind of housing estates and subways and things like that have these kind of decorative designs on. And that idea of those being kind of these sort of failed, this kind of a kind of real kind of utopian idea about adding kind of art and decoration to otherwise quite austere places. And then also there was this kind of glass wall, and we just thought, again, it's just that thing of like, that we were asked if we wanted to do this glass wall, and we kind of thought, well, you know, we can do it and it'll be a test, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't, we just won't tell anyone that we've done it. And
but also it's one of these things where they came to us and said, oh, we've got this 40 meter long glass wall. Or actually they said Perspex wall originally.
Yeah.
And then started showing us images of glass with kind of, it was very pretty, it had like, you know, kind of like trees on it and all that kind of stuff. Like, so actually what they wanted us to do was beautify a glass wall, but, which didn't seem to make sense.
We kind of figured we were doing these other parts, so we should do this as well. And we just thought, well, like, that it's going to look, you know, big glass wall is going to look quite kind of austere and quite sort of corporate in a way. So we just thought, and we're kind of big fans of Sol LeWitt, so we kind of thought we'd kind of copy Sol LeWitt a little bit and do our kind of take. But again, this uses that same kind of grid pattern that we've used elsewhere. But the initial proposal was to actually kind of cut into the glass, because in these, you know, you meet with these people and they always want to know, well, will it get broke? If somebody hits it with a sledgehammer, will it break? I mean, that comes up quite more than you would have. Of course, it'll break if you hit it with a sledgehammer. I mean, most things do, but you hope that people won't. But and one of the ideas was like, we can make it out of some sort of toughened plastic or Perspex or whatever. And it's like, well, that'll just get scratched because bush shelters get scratched and things. So we went off and we started thinking about that idea of kind of scratching and that kind of mark making as a way to create decoration. Our initial proposal was the idea that the glass would actually be kind of scratched, but as often happens with these projects, like, budget comes into play, so they didn't want to pay for the original kind of method. So we kind of tried out different ways of kind of creating an image of scratches, and actually we ended up just using kind of marker pen and drawing them out. And they kind of the panels sort of repeat and things. So there's, I think we did 8 different designs.
Yeah, just to make it clear, we drew them on pieces of paper.
Yeah, not onto the glass.
We kind of scanned and blew up, and that was produced. So it's kind of like a laminate. So the white is the printed kind of area between the glass.
Yeah, but so there's this sort of idea that that this sort of the sense of destruction is still there, or the kind of this kind of gesture of kind of mark making that could be an act of vandalism, but actually it turns into an act of
a process of creation, really.
Creation. So another one, we'll try and be quick here, actually, we're running out of time, but this one's also in the same area but a different developer, and we were just asked if we wanted to do something on their site, but we
nearly said no.
Yeah.
We really came really close, because they kept, we had loads of problems with them, and we almost said no, but actually what we produced we're quite happy with. So it's the idea, again, going back to the idea of the ruin and the kind of being this history, the plan, it's not, sorry, probably not that clear, but the plan, you can see like certain areas. So it was the idea that maybe this was like a kind of
the rectangle area
at the top. The rectangle at the top was a kind of like a some sort of hallway or a kind of a space that where there was a room and there were these walls coming off, and but it was kind of been exploded and been demolished, so you just left with the kind of trace of a building, partly because we'd been to a couple of parks where there'd been, I think, just like a kind of, you know, a changing room for kind of, you know, footballers and stuff, and that it had a tiled floor and the whole building had been demolished, but you'd be left with this kind of rectangle of tiles. So it's kind of a kind of memory of that, yeah. Really. So it's just these kind of like almost like these kind of traces of something that had been put there before. So they kind of they tend to disappear off the edge of the path as though the kind of the path is the only bit that's revealing them, and they're kind of hidden under the grass or whatever.
Yeah, and then but it's also this, I think we were really keen that it had this, there was kind of opportunities there. So it was just, it was this, it was kind of decoration. It was, it had, it continued these themes of the kind of ruin, but also there were kind of, there are points where you can follow lines and kind of actually sort of do like, you know, they're like the hexagon shapes are kind of embedded sort of stepping stones and things. And it's that idea of that, well, if you've got a path there, well, why not do something rather than just putting a plain tarmac or what do you call it?
Resin bran gravel.
Resin bran gravel or whatever. Like, do something with it that actually activates that space.
Yeah, the kind of the path can be the destination for play, I suppose, is what what we were thinking, rather than a place that takes you to a destination.
And it kind
play.
Of that kind of partly goes back to sort of seeing things like in Birmingham once. There's a kind of area with a embedded sort of floor design, and there was a little kid kind of who was sort of zigzagging along the kind of decoration, and the parent was just sort of walking in a straight line. And we kind of, I like that idea that you can make a piece of work that can do that, can allow for that, you know, the kind of people can just walk over it, or they can actually sort of engage with it. So there's a couple more shots. So yeah, quickly we'll talk about Instruction for Ordinary Utopia. So these were the kind of two sites in Frome that we were kind of interested in. And I think we were quite keen when we looked around to do something structural, but also in these kind of spaces that we were aware of and or had seen on a kind of previous visits, maybe, or certainly the this one on the left I'd seen. And it's that kind of, they're both spaces that are kind of on slightly on the outskirts of the kind of main, or the kind of underused spaces that are on the outskirts of the kind of main centre. So we were kind of looking at kind of points of reference in terms of sort of, yeah, like structural things, and there's a kind of Dan Graham, one of his sort of little labyrinth things at the bottom there, and then the top is this kind of, what do you call it, like
display
a
stand.
Yeah, poster, yeah. Advertising thing. And those kind of structures are always quite appealing to us. And also chain link fencing, kind of. This is the photo that we've got, we take a lot of these kind of photos, and on the front page of our website, we just have these kind of images of sort of random stuff that we kind of see that. And I think it's that kind of idea of always looking at the environment as a kind of potential source for sort of sculptural inspiration. So this is a kind of rough idea for one of the structures that we're doing that's going to go in the kind of woodland area. And it's going to be chain link fence with some boards, and we're going to kind of paint it up, and there's going to be holes for, so it's like a little kind of mini kind of maze thing.
So this is
kind of crawling through.
So the kind of, I guess in a way, one thing we talked about is that this is a kind of more an area for more play. So the kind of woods are where you might play. And then this is the other design, which is behind a former library. So it's kind of, this is the more complicative space, you know, the space you might sit and kind of read a book. And or there might be some kind of notices put on the part of it, so it's kind of a point of information as well as a kind of point of just kind of like, you know, sitting and thinking.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah. I mean, the limitations of SketchUp means that you can't, like, it won't look like that bench, but it's going to be this kind of, we like the idea of, again, it's going to be quite a rocky formed, kind of concrete form. I think maybe we're kind of up. We've been talking for quite a long time. Should we just leave it there? Because the next one's just what we've been doing in London recently. So should we leave it there? Is that a good time to stop? Okay.
So are there any questions? Or anything you wanted to kind of elaborate on or anything like that?
Any criticisms?
Okay.
I was just wondering about when you said about the cotton school, the mural work, you said what it means for us to be doing this now. Kind of just, what's that? Do you mean taking your influence from, like you were saying, that's not the soul of it and things, and then saying what it means for you to be making work?
Yeah, I think it was partly that idea that, it's really interesting how only in the past year or two, like the idea of kind of doing projects in public space, I think, as a lot of artists, I know that in the past year or two, a lot of artists who 3 years ago would never have done a public artwork are now doing public artworks. And I think that is partly a kind of financial thing because at the times less people are buying work. And I think there was a point that the idea of doing kind of municipal artwork was seen as being kind of slightly kind of unfashionable and things like that. But we liked a lot of that. But artists were actually referencing a lot of those kind of things, but actually maybe they wouldn't actually go out and do it themselves. And I think we were interested in that idea of like, well, okay, we've been referencing it. What happens when we actually start actually making it? And like, is there a way you can do it and still be kind of critical? I had a conversation once. We did a kind of group show at a kind of small commercial gallery in London, and I was talking to somebody about our work and what the kind of projects we were doing, and they said that, and she said, well, she was a collector, and she said, well, doesn't that just, well, you know, isn't there a danger that you just become like a commercial artist where you just get kind of, you know, you make work to order for whatever building and or whatever development? And I was just thinking, well, the work that you're buying half the time will be by somebody who's making it so they could sell it to you in their studio. But somehow there's this idea, because it's from a studio and it's presented in a gallery and then sold to a collector, that's sort of more of a noble idea of, or a kind of, maybe not noble, but like that's kind of an okay process. But her implication was that there was something more problem. It was problematic to kind of do sort of public artworks, where often you are working within certain constraints, like whether you can, you know, what you can and can't say, what you can. Like budgetary ones and stuff like that. But I think for us, there's that idea that if you start, we kind of tend to be a bit over ambitious, I think, and often, you know, we've wound up getting the projects done in the end. But also we, I think the constraints are a kind of another thing that you just deal with in an artist. If you're a painter, your constraints are the limitations of the paint, the way you paint, your ability to paint, the size that your canvas you can get into your studio or whatever. So I think when you're making work, you've always got some constraints. So I see the constraints you might get from a kind of public commission or publicly cited commission in kind of much the same way. And then it's up to us whether we actually do the project or not. It was that idea of whether you could still do those kind of projects and still kind of remain, like, still do it as a form of critique as much as just embracing it. And I think we kind of try and tread a line of doing that, really.
often we don't tell the developer that we're thinking about ruins and stuff like that. You have to kind of temper the language sometimes, but you know.
This is just a really simple yes, no question, I think. When you did the stuff on the playground floor, the stuff that you used to make the lines, was that like road markings?
Yeah, it's thermoplastic road marking tapes.
Will that last 25 years, like the year or?
No, it probably won't, but they couldn't guarantee that it would last that long, but we have got instructions that it can be repaired and replaced, so that's the kind of, that's the way around it, is that you say, well, this is the material, here's a colour match, and all that kind of stuff, so it's kind of
so there's something that they can continually buy.
And so you do it with the expectation that that will happen, there will be a maintenance schedule and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
You use SketchUp a lot for visualizing things and kind of seeing what stuff's going to look like. Just, do you see that sort of image creation as something that runs alongside your practice for development?
We've been talking about this recently because actually I think I'm a bit more keen on SketchUp than Tom is. I mean, it's got its limitations, but all kind of mediums have their limitations. But actually, I think SketchUp is like almost like an ideal sculpting material. The problem with SketchUp is how you then present.
Unless you want to do anything with a curve, like that's a curved.
Unless you want to get it, then it's hopeless. But it's kind of. Well, who needs curves, you know? But it's kind of a. I kind of really like using it. I think it's just kind of quite kind of a playful material. It can be quite frustrating as well, of course. But it's kind of. But I just quite enjoy kind of like, messing about making things in SketchUp just to see whether that will work. I mean, like, we've been using it for, kind of making models of a gallery where we've got a gallery show, and then you make little kind of scale models of the works and all that kind of stuff, which can take way longer than actually producing the work half the time. But it's kind of, I just kind of enjoy doing it, and I'd rather be doing that than physically making a scale model that kind of doesn't exist, that you can't kind of, get right inside and rotate and all that kind of stuff.
We have been trying to do, like, it's just one of those things, finding time to do it, but I think one of the things we've been trying to do is kind of use SketchUp but kind of put elements in there that are like sort of make it look or part of our work a bit more. So like we've been kind of adding in. One of the things that we didn't maybe talk about, but we've done is a sort of series of kind of drawings from old cartoons that usually are about art or kind of at the expense of art. And so we've been kind of cutting some of the figures out and using them instead of those kind of figures that you get that come with SketchUp of kind of people kind of, standing around or whatever. We've been kind of using these kind of cartoon pictures or kind of, I think, did we ever get round to doing any of what people? You did.
No,
some,
we didn't. We did some, but they didn't write.
Yeah,
cartoons look better.
Yeah. So it's like sort of, kind of creating something with it, doing something with, because it does always look generic. That's the thing with it. So it's kind of trying to find a way to.
It's trying to make it into have some sort of language with it, but also, like I say, it's then what do you do with it? How do you present it? How do you? Because you don't necessarily want just like a computer that people go to and they kind of like, scroll it around.
It starts getting a bit Second Life then,
The kind of flying, the films that you make with the flight, that doesn't really kind of work sometimes often. They might work as a bit of a kind of thing that you do and then think, oh, is this any good or not? But one thing we've talked about is making prints and things, but kind of maybe using like quite a kind of another slightly awkward print process like Risograph or something like that, so a kind of like a, you're bringing two slightly awkward things together to make something. So, but I don't know, I mean, it's kind of, and recently we talked about just having a bunch of images that we just project, but I don't know if that's going to happen or not for a show that's coming up, but I don't know, we might, may or may not do it, so we might decide to do something, we might not, but I don't know. Who knows? But we need to try and do it before loads of other people do. That's the main thing. It's like, you don't want to do after loads of other people have done it, then go, oh, I wish we'd done that,
Hello?
Yes, how do you price up change sort of halfway through the project. Does that happen
to you? We usually...
We usually guess really badly.
We kind of usually guess and then think we're being kind of right, this will cost X amount of money. Then we kind of go, well,
because word mesh, that's going to be
everything
cheap, right?
everything always costs more than you think it's going to, so we kind of add a bit on and then we're usually way lower than actually what it's going to cost. So usually we also hope that whoever is kind of commissioning it finds the money from somewhere.
We've got lucky
yeah, and we have been very lucky. I mean, the tree and the, you know, a bronze, where it's gone, that one, you know, a bronze tree that's 4 meters long. We got the fabricator to find a foundry who would do that and make, so the fabricator, MDM Props, have done the whole project. Whereas initially we spoke to some separately, like concrete company and foundry, and the foundries were coming back. We were going to big foundries like Pangolin and people like that, who were expensive, kind of very good, high quality art foundry. And their quote was like 100 grand or something like that for the one part. And we're like, well, we've got all these other elements we've got to do. So I don't know what they've actually paid for it, but MDM, the fabricators, have found like quite a small in terms of, well, small in terms of what, like actual business, but I think they must have a good sized foundry to be able to actually do it. I think, and they're not based in London, they're based like out in kind of somewhere, I don't know, but like not in London. And I think, you know, they kind of managed to do it for a good price, and MDM maybe are going to end up taking a bit of a hit on the whole project, because they would, you know, I guess they're not getting. They can't be making much money on it because the amount of work that's ended up going into it. But in a way, that's on them.
Yeah,
you know, it's good, and we're kind of really lucky that we.
I think one thing is that, as well, we've relied quite heavily on the fabricator that we put it. You know, we got a few fabricators to quote for it, and MDM would just manage to find that. You know, they know lots of foundries, and they knew one that would be able to do it for the amount that we had.
And I think the other thing with this project is what happened was it was almost like where normally you would go to a fabricator or somebody and say, okay, we want to do this, how much will it cost? They were told by the developer, I think, we have got this much money, and this is what we want to produce. Can you do it for the money? And they were like, well, yeah, I guess we can. And they, and you know, once they've signed the contract and signed the agreement and stuff, like the way they've gone about it, actually, I think it's difficult for them to turn around and say, actually, we need 200 grand. You know, it's kind of too late. So they kind of know that, like any, you know, that I guess they kind of know there's potential they could make a bit of a loss on it. But they seem cheerful enough about it, and they seem to like the project, so that's kind of, it's not all bad.
I was just wondering, seeing as your work's dealt so much with the concept of fail sculpture, how do you think you judge for your own stuff, whether it's success or failure in the work that you're creating?
I think in a way, it's kind of time will tell. I mean, that's the thing, a lot of this stuff hasn't actually occurred, or, I mean, kind of temporary projects are kind of less important. There are projects that we've made within the last 5 years that we're not particularly happy with. Unfortunately, weirdly, they're the ones that everyone seems to really like, but often that's the case. And I think the ones for us that have been compromised because, you know, you choose a site and then, you know, the person that owns the site says you can't do it there anymore, so you have to find somewhere else, and it means that there's one work in particular that springs to mind that the reading of the work was very different because the context changed. I don't know if it was a failure. We weren't as happy with it if it had been in the original location. I mean, maybe in a way that was a failure.
Yeah. Also,
but it's temporary, so it kind of doesn't matter so much. You know,
I think
the permanent ones, if they become failures, then... I mean, I don't know how we judge a failure. You know, I think a failure for us would be that we look back on it in 5 years' time and think, why did we ever make that?
Yeah.
That's the only way it would be a failure. I mean, if it got vandalised, it's not a failure. That's just, you know, we'd then look at a way to actually build, maybe, you know, rebuild something into it that makes, that uses that vandalism
or you,
as part of a process of kind of creation, really.
Yeah,
you know,
a starting point for a
different coloured concrete or a different colour, you know, you refill back in with a different colour concrete or something, so it's actually, there's something slightly weird and jarring about it. Mm. So you use the kind of the vandalism. Not that I'm kind of, you know, maybe part of it's almost open that do get vandalised, but
I don't think we also, like, when we talk about the failure of other artists' work, that's maybe a little bit unfair. I don't know. Sometimes we, you know, I was maybe saying some quite critical things about John Bridgman's work, but that's just a kind of a subjective opinion of taste. He, I'm sure, really loved all of his work. He didn't see it as a failure. So, like, that's the other thing. Other people might think our work's a failure, but that's on them.
But also with someone like John, people like John Bridgman, you know, the kind of it set up the failure because it's almost, it was trying to create something utopian, and that's just, you know, it's just not going to happen. So it's kind of, I mean, maybe failure is kind of overemphasizing it a bit. Maybe it's more that I think it's one of these things we say, oh, we're drawn to the flaws in things, but what hasn't got flaws, you know? So it's kind of, what is perfect? So it's kind of, there isn't, that, you know, we could be drawn to quite a lot of things, really.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, I guess it's...
We're not drawn to, like, I was just thinking about drawn to the flaws in things, like the, just somebody like, I was just trying to think about Henry Moore or somebody like that, like, I don't know. I think
no, but I'm more likely to take a photograph of a Henry Moore that's been graffitied than one that hasn't, because I'm interested in that point, you know, at which somebody's decided to do something to something as kind of, well, maybe perfect as Henry Moore, you know. Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about what those different contexts, maybe more about the gallery or something like the context in Froome, what that kind of allows you to explore against the expectations of something that's permanent, like a 25-year lifespan, those sorts of things. Like the structures, the ideas that you're referencing, say, for the work for Instructions for an Ordinary Utopia are quite different, aren't they, than what you're doing in the Battersea.
Yeah.
Very different materials, very different approaches, different set of ideas.
Yeah, but I kind of think that they're almost, they could potentially be interchangeable. But obviously you'd have to change the technique for which they're produced. I mean, there's no reason why we wouldn't do galvanised fencing for a permanent project, but it's just, it would have to be, you know, of a certain standard, and maybe what we do to it would be a kind of, you know, a certain.
And I think they inform it, and they inform each other as well. Like when we've been working on this project, the Battersea one, there's been things that have come up while we've been doing it. We said, oh, actually, you know, that would make a really nice just sculpture that is for more for a gallery context or just for a, you know, something like that. And then, or, you know, we should make that in the studio sometime. And then the other way is that when we're kind of making studio works, or we've been saying, well, what would be really nice is to kind of do a permanent public artwork project. So I'll just, you know, to flick through to the stuff that we've been kind of making. So we're doing a residency in London at this place, Flat Time House, which is John Latham's old house. So we've been kind of looking at these sort of broken bollards and stuff, and these are still in process. So we've made these kind of bollard sculptures. But like while we've been making them, we've been saying, oh, it'd be really nice to do some bollard, that would be a public art commission somewhere, you know, you just say, well, okay, for the whole site we want to do all of the bollards for the whole site, and we'll design a set of bollards and they get used everywhere. So like these two things kind of inform each other, but yeah, I think that, you know,
But I think initially we approached them in this potentially approached them the same way, and then it's just like how that evolves.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess there are obvious differences, but I don't really know. It's, I think we were almost too close to it as well to see what those are, because we kind of, there's this sort of, you know, the thread of how you get to that point. It's hard to kind of remove that from looking at them. What do you think is sort of distinct differences between those kind of things?
Well, I suppose I'm thinking, you know, from outside of being an artist, just the way that those different contexts have different sets of expectations around them, time, durational contexts, both in terms of time and in physicality, the way they reference different, kind of community contexts or the user context and all of that, and that they're working across those different spaces or, you know, and expectations allows you to kind of explore different parts of your interests. You know, different contexts pull different bits of ideas in different directions. I'm just kind of thinking about that way that if you look at, say, the Cambridge housing estate one, and then making those acoustic ruin kind of walls, and then just flipping that, you know, and saying, and imagining what it would be like if you were then talking to the people who were commissioning that and saying, what we're going to do is we're going to make this chain link fencing maze thing on the garden with some plywood panels and spray it, you know, like it's been pre-vandalised.
Yeah.
And kids will climb through it and rip their jumpers, and, you know, but it'll be great because it's, you know, kind of, it's not something they're expecting to do, and they'd look at you like you were mad.
Yeah.
And tell you they didn't want you to do that. So you obviously are then thinking about different parts of the vocabulary of ideas that you're interested in, and different contexts allow you to do different things. I mean, for example, really simple things like when we've all been thinking about what to do in those spaces in Froome. You know, we've got a certain amount of money, certain ideas start to go in a certain direction, and that starts to kind of fold together to make an evolving idea. Just like the same happens in Battersea, you know, you've got a very different set of expectations, different physical, financial ability, which draws out something else. So I suppose what I'm trying to get at is it doesn't seem from what the way you're talking about it, like, and maybe there's an expectation from people that maybe the most amount of money and, you know, the most privilege in a way that you're afforded means that you're going to make the best work or the most exciting work to you. I suppose I'm just thinking about that, about the variety of experiences and how that might bring out work that for you might have really interesting value. You know, for example, you might do a gallery-based show that might be more important than a really major public artwork.
Inevitably. I think there is, you know, how people look at, like, how people, who and how they, people are going to engage with it is kind of always a kind of point, is an interest, you know, the whole thing with doing, like, public art. And so it's even the stuff with, especially, like, the stuff that in the schools that we've been doing with Aldo, is that you like, the school, people at the school are going to see those. Most people in terms of our audience who are going to ever see them will see them in images. They won't actually ever experience them. And that, you know, that's fine. That's kind of the context and stuff. But, I don't know. I just think, I've lost my train of thought. When you were talking, I was thinking something really good that I was going to say, but I can't remember what it was. You got anything to add? Yeah. Nothing. No, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was going to say is that actually those concrete, we could quite easily do something like those concrete walls and have them in a gallery. You know, that could quite easily occur. But obviously there is an expectation when you're dealing with, you know, large sums of money that what you're going to build is more substantial. And I mean, I am quite amazed that we've got away with producing those walls the way we did, really.
Yeah.
It was good that we were working with good architects, that, you know. So
but it's also that how we think about it is one thing, but how you get, like, do it is, can often be... So this one, all we talked... We didn't talk about the idea of kind of the scratched glass or vandalised glass. We just talked about them being, like, having this sort of handmade... thing. We talked about the idea of the being kind of hand done, and because we thought, you know,
Yeah, I mean, they were talking. I mean, it's kind of interesting because the architects, these buildings, the way the architects talk about these buildings, you think they were arts and crafts things, you know, yeah. They're bricks from Holland, and they're kind of, you know, kind of very particular brick, and they're a certain dimension and all the rest of it. And they've got this idea that they're very craft, they're almost like craft thing. So we were kind of tapping in, you know, talking about that, kind of following their lead a little bit. But we have this other thing in the background that actually gives it kind of a bit more kind of teeth and a bit more context for us. And that's quite important, I guess, that we're not just going, let's just make some pretty flowers on the wall, you know.
But like when we were sort of working on this and working out the designs, we were saying what would be really nice to do at some point a kind of gallery version of it, and even with the you know, the concrete walls and stuff, but do it with like graffiti and kind of piss stains against it and stuff like that. It'd be kind of like, so we start like where we before we've appropriated like those kind of bollards or paving slabs that we're doing at the moment, or kind of other, you know, other people's play sculptures or whatever, we actually start appropriating our own work and make that as a starting point for kind of studio works. Whether we'll do that, and, you know, but it's kind of a potential kind of, you know, it'd be kind of quite fun to do it, you know, if the right opportunity comes up.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up.
Yeah. So.